Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Never quit. Never quit radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. As always, thank you guys so much for listening and watching, and please don't forget to hit that like and subscribe button if you like to see the show. So today, we've got a great guest for you, but before we get to him, let's kick it off with our weekly Patreon question. And this week we have, what is the most surprising lesson that you've learned throughout your training that you kind of apply to everyday life?
Go ahead, brother. You got one?
Oh, that's on me. All right, sweet. I'm happy to answer that one. I think probably the biggest lesson that I learned during training that you can apply to everyday life is when things go really, really bad, one of the best ways of dealing with it and actually pushing through and finding the strength to push through is laugh at it. Find something funny about the situation and how ridiculous it is. And the more ridiculous the situation is, the more painful the situation is, find something to laugh at. And that'll carry you through, the worst of it.
That is good.
Dude, we practice that so hard, and it is, that's the only way we get through stuff, is that when that kick-ass sense of humor comes in.
Exactly.
It truly is. I think you got to train in those environments too. That's why Bud sucks so bad. Like, the environments are there. We just got to put you in there and let you suffer until you get your sense of humor back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that also helps, you know, if you talking about Buds, I mean, I think it selects for guys who kind of have that like truly deep sense of humor. Mm-hmm. When things are the worst and they can laugh, because you have guys that are really funny that don't make it through. Because that's not the thing. It's not a guy who's funny. It's a guy who truly has a sense of humor and can laugh when things are the absolute worst.
Yeah.
You know, just like,
and you don't see that until that environment shows up. It's like, I don't see it. He's not funny. Never even. I was like, just wait. Wait till they put that sumbitch in the vice, dude, and he will freaking shine. That's a good one.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't have any training.
Something that I guess I've learned throughout just training throughout high school and stuff, I would say, a lot of times you're stronger in numbers. So if you just like training for football and stuff, if you've got a good group with you, if you've got some buddies that always have your back, then you always know that they're going to help you out if something happens. And you can also apply that to everyday life. You know, if you're going through anything and you have your buddy right there and you know that he's going to be with you, you can kind of free fall and push the boundaries a little bit.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, the great amen to that.
The great sense of humor. It takes it everywhere. I mean, and a team's unstoppable. And you can actually get a bunch of guys that aren't that good at their particular skill set, but if they have fun together, they're unstoppable. You can always tell a good team, a sports team, football, man, when they're winning, and I'm talking about really winning, it's because they love each other. And they have the best time with each other, not only in the battlefield, but at home, and then when they're having – they're always together. It's like, hey, man, when we get off work, I want to hang out with him just because of this, because it's that's how you know. And you can see them. They normally don't go out in the open. Like they won't go out and show that off, man, but if you're lucky enough to be somewhere where they're at and you can see that happening, it's the most amazing thing for sure. That sense of humor, man, or great attitude, I guess is what you call it, right? A great attitude?
Yeah, good attitude, but sense of humor. The ability to laugh, it's not about just being optimistic. It's about, because like optimistic people, they've got a good attitude, but it's like just being laugh at and go like, yo, this is really bad, being fatalistic, like this is really bad. This is probably not going to end well, but we're going to laugh about it while we're going through it.
Have you ever met Adam Downs? Do you know Adam Downs?
No, never heard.
Bro?
Never heard of him.
He's the epitome of that. I mean, we would get in some stuff. I'll never forget, he got shot at. I mean, really shot at. And turns around and goes, oh, did you effing see that? He's like, almost got killed, dude. And I mean, just laughing and just hysteria. And I was like, oh, it's awesome. I mean, you look so cool doing that. You know, that kind of flip that we have. I'll never forget that. I was like, dude, you almost got killed. Did you see that?
One of the things that I've taken from your stories that I think applies to daily life is when y'all would have to just, no matter what, your room, you would never pass inspection. No matter what, you would never pass, like, for your dress code, you know, whatever. Like, you were always going to fail because that's how the system was set up.
Yeah.
And, but you still had to continue to do it. And that, to me, as someone that's never been through anything like that, I took that and applied it to life. Like, sometimes things are going to suck and you're going to get told you're not good enough or you didn't do it, you know, perfect, but you still have to try again the next day and put that effort.
What's that saying we'd have? I mean, we'd try to pass out the next day, we'd roll in and everyone would be rolling out to get beat and be like, hey, we suck again. You know what I'm talking about? It's like always something, man. We suck again.
Yeah.
I'll never.
Yeah, that's actually funny. Quick anecdote on that. So with the room cleaning and the inspections and stuff and such during Buds, I always put in effort. I always made sure that my uniforms looked good. I made sure I cleaned my room, but I wasn't going to stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning trying to find every single grain of sand because I knew exactly what you said. I was like, they're going to come in here, throw sand on the ground, on the floor, and then say that your floor is sandy, and then they're going to beat you. And you have to pass both the barracks inspection and the uniform inspection. So I remember when I first started Buds, all the guys in my room, they were like, no, we got to stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, guys, no, we got to clean the room, do our best, but get some sleep. That's what you need. That's what you need to get through here. I was like, the lesson is not about cleaning your room. The lesson is about just taking a beating and whatnot. And so it was funny because all the guys in that room who were like pushing us to clean the room and clean the room, all three of them quit. And then I was the only guy who was like, no, get sleep. And I was the only guy who made it through. Wow. So it was just kind of like, just kind of accepting, hey, here's the situation. Do your best, but don't kill yourself.
Cause I feel like that's just a situation where they're just looking to see if you're going to quit because you keep getting told that you failed, no matter how hard you try.
I mean, you got your attitude, your everything's in that. And then they're just like, nope. Instructors would walk by with a pocket full of sand and throw it into the freaking room in front of you. And then walk past, and then another instructor would walk into your room and go, oh, I guess you didn't clean your shit. I mean,
exactly.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable, man. I'll talk about a mind. Dude, SEALs, they can mind rape you like you can't freaking believe, man.
I think that's a good lesson for our younger generation right now, too, is that a lot of times it's just a test and just don't freaking quit.
That's something we do that to ourselves, man. No, that's a good question. All right, brother, man. Thank you again for coming on here and doing this. I'm excited to share your story. Yeah. It's good, man. So let's back this all the way up, man. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And okay, so is that where your people are from?
Yeah, that's where my family is, and that's home.
So tell me your full name. Pronounce that.
Yeah, so it's Ephraim Matos or Ephraim Matos or Ephraim Matos. There's so many different weird pronunciations of my first name. Every country I go to says it's supposed to be said a different way.
Right.
I grew up being called Ephraim, but I also go by Ephraim. It really doesn't matter.
Right. That's from the Bible.
Big E, I know you're talking to me.
Right?
Yeah, Old Testament. Yeah.
Old Testament, right? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yep.
All right. You got a middle name? They strap one of those on you?
I do. My middle name is Dwayne. Wayne, named after my grandfather.
Ephraim. Ephraim's old school. And he rolls in with the yeah. D-Wayne.
Dwayne, yeah.
Old D-Wayne.
He would always say, help me, Dwayne the bathtub, I'm drowning. That's like this joke my grandfather would always say to me because he thought it was the funniest thing ever. And I was like, all right. You know, I actually is funny now.
God, bro, next time we're in person, we meet up, it's coming out of me. I'm throwing it down on you from across the room. Like, D-Wayne. All right, cool.
That's me.
Yeah, you got so family history of military service?
My dad was actually in the Air Force Reserve, so he was just he was flight crew on 30. He's an enlisted guy, and so after 9/11 he got activated and spent a lot of time overseas. He would do these 3 or 4 month deployment rotations over to the Middle East, Kuwait, Iraq. I think he did a little bit in Afghanistan as well. But transporting troops and moving. A lot of the stuff he did was actually they would fly the bodies of the dead and the draped in the coffins, and they would fly them to Germany from Iraq or Kuwait or wherever, and then take them to Germany. Also, lots of moving wounded, evacuating wounded, and things like that. So yeah, he's flying around the big cargo planes keeping things moving. So that was my family's history, I guess, of service.
What year? How old were you when 9/11 happened?
I was in fourth grade. I guess it would have been 8 or 9, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, wow. You're a youngin'.
How'd you even hear about the SEALs?
That's a good question. As I got a little older, I decided I wanted to do the military thing. I saw Black Hawk Down I want to be Rangers or something. But then I started looking into all the different special operations units, and SEALs, of course, would pop up in books or online or whatever. Actually a huge inspiration for joining the SEALs, and like what really made me understand the SEALs was actually your book, Lone Survivor, believe it or not.
Wow.
I got that when I was in early high school. I forget exactly when it was, or maybe it was like middle of high school. I got that book and I read it in like 2 days. I'd never read a book that big that fast before. And I was just fascinated by it. And then I think it was probably 6 or 8 months later, I ended up deciding to, I was like, all right, I'm going to go for the SEALs. Out of any of these other units, I'm going to go for the SEALs. And so I decided to go for
it. So let me ask you this. If we travel back in time a little bit, what branch are you going into now?
Oh, wow. If I was to go in right now?
Yeah. If we had to go back and they were all that stuff, everything we know presented it, where would you go now?
I always tell anybody who wants to join special operations or whatever, I'm like, join the Air Force,
as a
PJ.
Yeah. Right?
As a PJ or a CCT.
Oh,
I was
man.
Like, that's the way to go.
That's
dude.
The way to go.
Marcus tells.
I swear by that. I'm like, hey, man. And people laugh. I'm like, I'm serious when I say that.
Yeah, exactly.
And every other team guy under our breath would be like, yeah, man, they're pretty cool, man. They got it figured out.
Yeah, they've got a specific job set. So when you join, you know, CCTs or pararescues, like you're either gonna be a medical guy or you're gonna be a combat controller. Both of those are you're gonna have an actual skill set. And then the other thing you don't really think about is because you're with the Air Force, they have sort of it seems like a per capita much lower budget. So those guys have like all the best gear. Mm-hmm. They're getting all the best training and whatnot. And then they've got like a very specific job that they're gonna be a do, which is pretty cool. And they get embedded with
everybody,
with SF and SEALs and everybody. Yeah, they get to do all this different stuff. So yeah, definitely probably Air Force CCT. I enjoy being a JTAC.
Bro, I ran into them when I was at 18 Delta when they were going through their training, and then again when we were in Afghanistan, my first push there. They had their own rooms off to the side, uniforms up by middle. Like, who is that dude, man? You know what I'm talking about? And then we operated for months, and then you realize, like, hey, man, you're not even a freaking SEAL. What do you do? And they're like, I can't talk about it. And I'm like, that's my line.
Yeah.
For sure. For sure. Right on, man. Okay, so when did you join?
So I was 17 when my parents both went into the recruiter. So this was 2010, early 2010. My parents went in, signed the paperwork for me to join, and then graduated high school a couple months later, and then shipped off to boot camp end of 2018, and then end of 2010, excuse me, and then all of 2011 was basically buds at that point.
Yeah.
What class were you?
I went through Hell Week with class 289. I got injured during Hell Week, and so I classed back up with 291 and finished the pipeline with them.
Good for you, man. Way to put out. Like, my brother made it through in one fell swoop. That's because he didn't put out hard enough.
Yeah.
Them freaking guys that make it through in just one stretch, I'm like, dude.
But you know, made honor. He was honor man too. Yeah.
My brother's a loser. Overachieving Nexus. Good for you, bro. That's great. I didn't make it in one stop. I had some extra benefit out there, man.
Isn't your brother in Congress now?
He is. That's what I said, man. He's like this overachieving Nexus, man.
That's great. Good for him, man.
He's got a great jawline and everything. It's stupid. You know?
Y'all have the same jawline.
Oh, that's too funny.
Yeah, he's a good dude, man. Whatever. I was born with him. All right, so you come in to... where was your first...
291.
Yeah, 291 when you came out of there. Where's your first command?
I was West Coast, Team 1.
Yeah, right. No fun one.
Yeah.
What was your hurdle in buds? What got you in buds?
Like, what was my thing? Yeah. Man, honestly, it wasn't anything in particular. It was just the cumulative everything. I need my sleep. I'm a big baby. I want to sleep. So the sleep deprivation was, you know, not great. But honestly, it's just the accumulation of everything. You know, during Hell Week, I had a really low point where I actually, the thought of quitting actually went through my mind because before Hell Week, a couple of days before that, I got VGE, viral gastroenteritis. And so I'd spent the entire 48 hours prior to Hell Week just vomiting and diarrhea uncontrollably. And then so we started Hell Week. I started out super weak. And I believe it was Sunday night or Monday morning. I don't really know exactly when. That's when I've got a bulging disc because one of the guys doing log PT, he dropped the log. All the weight shifted to my back because he was the guy right next to me. And so anyway, I didn't rupture a disc. It was just bulging.
Right.
But that was excruciatingly painful. So I had VGE, bulging disc. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning on Monday. Or I don't even know what time it is. We're laying in the water doing rocking chairs. And I'm just like, what am I doing? There's no way I'm going to be able to survive this the next few days. And so then there was a part of me that was like, well, I remember like this thought went through my brain, like I'm done. Meaning like, there's no way I'm going to be able to make it through. Like I'm going to get injured I'm going to slow down to the point where they're going to kick me out. So all these negative thoughts were going in my head. And then I just sort of snapped out of it. I sort of pictured what I wanted to be in the future and snapped out of it. And then from that point forward, the thought of quitting never even crossed my mind. And I got mad at the instructors at that point. And I realized like, you guys almost got me. Like I was this close. You guys almost got me. And so then from that point forward, it just became a personal war against the instructors, like no matter what they did.
Speaking it wasn't of, gonna faze me. In 2011, did you have Mikey Sowers as an instructor?
Yes, Sowers was one of my instructors. Yeah.
Yeah, and... Yeah.
How about that guy? He's great.
Ray Mendoza would have been an instructor at that time.
Mendoza was there around that time. Yeah, Eddie Gallagher was one of my instructors.
And Dave Bloom
was there. I'm trying to...
Bloom.
Who's that?
Dave Bloom.
Bloom. I think, yes. Bloom. Yeah. Yep.
That's 2011. Yeah. I was going, Marcus would bring me to the Buds compound like whenever we were in San Diego, and I would get to walk around and see y'all running around and everything. So.
Oh, that was you. I remember seeing you. No, not really. But right? That was you laughing at us. How dare you.
I remember that.
Yeah, that's awesome. We love all of those guys. Were they hard on you?
Yeah, for sure. Tough but fair. They were all tough but
firm
fair.
But fair.
Yeah.
It was a fair ass beating. You know, it was just like yeah. It was fair. The way they doled it.
You volunteered for it. You can leave whenever you want. You don't got to be here.
What you were talking about. There's an interim in buds. Like some people, like, oh, the run got me, or the swim got me, or the cold got me. But then there's the accumulation of the bullshit. They can sneak up on you. I remember Hell Week. I think it was right before Around the World. I just had. A chance to come out of medical, I slipped around the drying cage, and I had a dry uniform on for the first time ever.
Oh, nice.
You know what I'm talking? Remember what that felt like?
Nice.
It's kind of warm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And so I was looking around. I was like, just going to stay dry for about 5 minutes. I don't want nobody to see me. And this freaking instructor that just could dole it out, right? But then could dole it out with a smart-ass attitude, so it made it worse. I walk around the corner, bro, and he's freaking standing there with a water hose running, just looking at me. Well, he was waiting for somebody to come around there, and sure enough, it was me. And he goes, oh, Latrell. Man, I've been waiting on you, bro. Come right on over here. And he started making me stretch, just stretch while he was rolling that hose over the top of me. And I was like, you know, I've quit better things than this. My moment, right? You know, and then
I was thinking about that. Like, so during our Hell Week, I remember they had like the giant 5 gallon paint buckets, you know, of course, are empty.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes, but your uniform is in there.
Your uniform is in there, full of water.
Yeah, yeah. And so there was no.
Which was
no
miraculous because mine didn't have that. That's why I was like, wait a minute.
Oh, that's amazing.
Because normally you walk around a corner, your uniform's in that bucket, it's full of water, your boots, so you got to put on the dry or the wet. It sucks so bad, man. Because your attitude is just freaking ridiculous. And I was so happy. I was like, dry uniform. All right.
So they just forgot to
put water in it, or they were still filling them up when I ran in there and grabbed that sucker, but shit, didn't work.
My God. That
person was standing there waiting on me when I came around that corner, dude. Oh, bro. Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Let's go. All right, so you go over to one, and then you deployed how many times with them?
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
I did 2 deployments with one. My first was to Afghanistan, and then my second was to Southeast Asia. Mm. So my first deployment, luckily, we got to get after it. It was 2014, summer 2014. So good summer deployment. And the area that we were operating in was in Logar. And so virtually everything that we did was daylight patrols. We basically could have been infantry, honestly. And we actually had paratroopers who were assigned to our outpost to guard it, and we would attach a squad of those guys to come out with us because they were good dudes.
And they
integrated just fine because it was daytime fighting in the valleys there. Yeah,
those 82nd boys, those Marines that come in, you know, the infantry dudes, the freaking street meat, man, they can fight their asses off.
Nothing but respect for those guys.
Yeah,
love working with them.
But respect.
Yeah, and that was the thing too, is at first, you know, we were attached to the 82nd guys to us like a SWAT, and I wasn't sure exactly how that was going to work, but everything we did was they everything was fine. Everything was great. They did a great job, totally dependable. Got their ass off, and it was a real pleasure working with those guys. Yeah.
Yeah, they're good, man. I remember too when they was like, "Hey, you guys are assigned to them." I was like, "What do? You're just assigned to them." Like, Roger that, man. Just roll off of whatever they do. And that's how it usually worked, for sure. I remember that.
Yeah.
Man. All right. So you get back, then you punch over to where?
I just did the 2014 deployment to Afghanistan, 2016 deployment to Southeast Asia, and then right after that, I got out. I did my 6 years and 4 months, and got out pretty much immediately. Didn't do shore duty or anything like that. So just one command and rolled out.
What year was that?
I got out 2017. It was April of 2017 when I left. Yeah,
it feels like that was a big transition year for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, a lot of guys getting out that year.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. And the reason I got out was because so when I was in Afghanistan, so this kind of goes into my story, that when I was in Afghanistan, we were on one of those daytime patrols. We came across a backpack that we believe, or we know had an IED in it. So the dog sat on it. And so we knew that there was an ID in there. We blew it in. And then because of that, the Taliban knew exactly where we were, and they thought that we had wounded. So they started swarming us, and they were gathering in one particular place to try and ambush us because they knew the route that we had to walk.
Yeah.
And so we ended up getting to that position first before the Taliban, and ended up smoking all of them. And but during the firefight, one of our Afghan allies, he was shot 3 or 4 times in like the hips. And so we moved back several tree lines, called in airstrikes on the position that the Taliban had just been in. And we set up a perimeter to call in a medevac helicopter. And when we set up the perimeter, we started intercepting radio chatter from the Taliban saying that they were going to attack us from the south. And I was the farthest guy on the south in an entirely exposed position with a 46, a machine gun. And my job was basically to cover the south. Yeah, exactly. And so then all the radio chatter, they're like, hey, Matos, you know, you're like, they're going to be coming from action.
You're up.
You're up. Yeah. And I was like, all right, here we go. And so sure enough, I don't know, 10 minutes later, I start seeing heads in this tree line. And I'm waiting to see a weapon. They're moving sort of along the tree line. And so I'm ready to go, finger on the trigger. Pressure already on the trigger, just kind of waiting for them to come out so I can get a body shot. And as soon as two heads pop out, it turns out it's two little girls. And one was maybe 10, the other one was maybe like 5 or 6. Two little girls, and screaming, and oh, not screaming, but they're like weeping and they're crying and they're running. They start running straight at me. And they're both wearing backpacks that are just like the backpack that we just blew up an hour earlier.
Yeah.
In place. And they're running straight at me, exactly from the direction that the Taliban said they were going to attack us from. And so I start screaming at these little girls. I'm like, get away, get away, get away. You know, I put my crosshairs on the first girl's face. I'm laying down so I'm able to stabilize. And with my left hand, I'm waving at them so they see me. And I'm like, get away. I'm screaming at them. And eventually they get to the point where if they detonated their bombs, they would have hurt me or killed me.
Oh, right,
they would
close.
Not have hurt my. Yeah, but they would not have hurt my team. They would not have hurt my team. And then I was like, if they gone another step and a half, like I would have had to take the shot because, I was like, I can't let you detonate and hurt my team. I was like, I'll give you that extra a little bit. I'll put myself at risk, but I'm not gonna put my team at risk on this one. In hindsight, maybe I should have made a different decision, but that was my decision at the moment. And eventually those girls stopped like right before I squeezed the trigger, and I'm like screaming at them. And then I could just see tears are going down their face, and then they turn around and they run away. Sure enough, the backpacks they were wearing were the same exact kind that we had just blown up. And then no Taliban attack came from the south or from any direction at any point. And so I don't know for sure that those girls were the Taliban attack, but all indications point to that basically the Taliban sent these little girls right at me for me to shoot them. And I almost wonder if the Taliban were filming from a vantage point or something like that, hoping to maybe get it on film or something. I don't know.
Because they do that. They'll do that.
Yeah, exactly. So, but what that did was it got my head going, and I just realized, I was like, where did those little girls run back to? You know, I was like, they're, you know, these girls, they're caught in the middle of this war. Obviously, possibly the Taliban just sent them out after me. You know, I was like, and that just got me thinking about, you know, all these different conflicts that are going on around the world. There's nobody there to really help the people that are caught in the middle. And so I decided, during my second deployment, I was in Southeast Asia, and we were in Thailand for like 6 weeks. And I remember being frustrated because I was like, we have a full platoon of SEALs here with all of our weapons, all of our ammo. You know, we're working with the Thai SEALs, and it was a good time. We had a really good time. But I was like, we're a 4-hour helicopter ride away from villages across the border in Myanmar, Burma, where people are being raped and murdered and massacred and genocide is happening. And I understand why the U.S. government, we can't just go wherever we want just go pick fights wherever we want. But I just remember feeling like, no, I need to go help those people. I need to go. I'm just one guy. I'm not Rambo. I can't, you know, save everybody, but I can go do something. I can village. I can do something. And so ultimately that's why in 2017, I decided to get out because I wanted to go seek out active conflict zones or capital and just see what I could do to help. I didn't know what that would look like. I didn't know the difference between a nonprofit or a for-profit organization. I didn't know anything, but I was just, I'm going to go there. I'm going to help. And I'm going to figure this thing out. And that ultimately led to what I do now.
So how long between the time you got out and you rolled back in to that organization?
I was actually still on leave.
That's what I thought.
So I took leave at the end of my
so no time at all. Navy
no time, zero time, zero, zero time. Yeah, I was actually in firefights. I was in a firefight in Afghanistan. I'm sorry, firefight in Iraq. Before my last day in the Navy, just as a civilian volunteer working with another aid group and such over there, just volunteering and figuring out what I was going to do. I thought I was just going to be doing humanitarian aid work. So 2017, I fly over to buy a one-way ticket to Iraq. Northern Iraq, Kurdistan, and up with another aid group. And I thought we'd just be doing humanitarian aid work sort of in the conflict zone. And I was like, perfect, you're a good fit. I'll just go hand out water bottles and bandages. But we ended up being frontline combat medics for the Iraqi army because they didn't have medics. And so they were like, you guys know TCCC, tactical combat casualty care. And so we were based medics. And so we ended up frontline, shoulder to shoulder with the Iraqi army, treating their wounded as they're clearing ISIS out of little towns, and then also when they went into Mosul as well.
What are their attitudes? Was it different? Because remember when we're in and we're working with them, I'm not saying it was bad. It's great. It's good. I mean, we got along with them famously. Still got friends from that. Is it different when you show back up as a civilian with no backup? Then they, I would imagine they looked at you a little bit differently with more favor because like, hey man, this guy's freaking hanging his balls out over here for us.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, I'd never been to Iraq as in the military. Again, my first time into Iraq was as a civilian, just flying over there. So I don't, as far as specifically the Iraqi army, I don't know if there was any difference. But I will say, we got along with those guys great. We like loved those guys to death. You know, they understood that we were there. They understood we weren't military. They totally understood that, and they were super grateful that we were there to help them out and provide them medical care. And it was a real honor to work with those guys. And I will also say too, the bravery of the Iraqi soldiers. If you look at how they compare to like SEALs or U.S. military training and standards, they didn't meet that sort of those standards, right? They weren't super organized. Marksmanship based non-existent. A lot of those things. So a lot of the training wasn't there. But as far as their courage and their willingness to go toe to toe with ISIS, and I watched multiple times, you know, an Iraqi army tank would drive up, get blown up by an ISIS car bomb, and then next up would just keep going, and then they would get blown up, and then the next tip, and then the next one would keep going and hit a landmine, and then the next one would just be up and keep going. These guys were getting killed. The Iraqi soldiers were getting killed and wounded like crazy, like World War II level casualties, and they would just show up every day. And they would fight to liberate their cities. And I was very impressed with them. And it was really an honor to be able to work with those guys and serve them by taking care of what we could medically. Yeah.
How do the aid programs even find out where to go or who to embed with?
Yeah. So the organization that I volunteered with when I was there, they were called FBR, Free Burma Rangers. And they had been operating in the area for several years. And so when they first showed up, I believe they had just been sort of doing humanitarian aid distributions and things. And during that time, there was an Iraqi army unit that had said, hey, we need supplies out here because we keep liberating these villages and nobody's coming to help us and nobody's coming to help these refugees or IDPs. And so because if you look at like larger organizations, like the big NGOs, all the super famous ones, they are not going to go into these areas where there's active fighting and whatnot. And it makes sense. They're not trained for that. They're not built for that. But they'll run the refugee camps and such. But so there's this gap between where people are being freed from, you know, or caught in the middle of crossfire to the point where they get to a refugee camp. And so anyway, the Iraqi army had asked specifically that this organization come in and help. They're like, hey, can you guys deliver food and aid? And so they did. And then built the relationship and we're like, hey, can you guys stay with us? Can you provide medical care? And and whatnot. And so then the relationship was built over the course of several years. And that's similar to the model that we use as well, is we show up. So I run an organization called Stronghold Rescue and Relief now. And that's what we do. We go in, we assist every way that we can, and we build relationships by showing them that we care, we're here to help. We're not crazy. We're not here to get into gunfights. We just want to help you during this horrible, horrible time that you're going through.
Are you allowed to get in gunfights? I mean, if someone's shooting at you?
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, absolutely. I guess we'll kind of dive into a little bit of like what my organization does. So at Stronghold, we provide frontline mentorship for, you know, active ongoing security threats to villages and things like that. So if a village or a particular tribe is facing genocide, we'll go in, we'll advise them on what it is that they already have and say, hey, here's how you should best use resources that you already have to help protect people. In Burma, for example, we send in lots of just handheld radios, just civilian grade handheld radios. So civilians can communicate with each other in their villages, and they can coordinate when the Burma army comes in to massacre a village, they know where to run, they know where to find food. And then of course, we'll bring aid. And then the other aspect of what we do is evacuation and medical, medical evacuations and such. And so we're providing frontline medical care and then evacuating people all the way out, and getting them to clinics and such from the point of injury to higher levels of care and such. So my point is, we are working in active conflict zones. And so because of that, if the locals allow us to carry a weapon and they give us one, then we'll carry one, of course. And so we often are armed because the bad guys, they'll shoot us probably sooner than they'd shoot the locals.
Yeah, first.
So,
there's no repercussions for that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
There's just not, because you're not from there. And if it's just, it's crazy how the villages will kill each other to exterminate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they'll just go in there to do that. We don't fathom that here in the States. There's a lot of things that we don't fathom here in the States that go down everywhere else.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so that's part of my job, the way I see it, is trying to connect the reality of what's going on around the world, then try to communicate that to the US audience. Because there's this certain level of evil that people just don't see. They just don't understand. They don't understand that a military unit would go into a village and just slaughter everybody, just kill them all after raping the women. But they'll kill the kids. They'll kill the moms, the dad. They'll kill everybody. Mm. And they'll just burn the bodies. And they don't care. And so in Burma, for example, as well, the Burma army, they will go into a village. And typically at this point, the villagers are able to run away. People don't get caught all that often, but it does happen. And usually in small numbers. If that happens, you're just sort of screwed. But if so what will happen is most of the time people will run away from the villages. So the villages will be clear. And then the Burma army will go into that village and they will sort of use it as an outpost for maybe a day, maybe a month, maybe a year, who knows. But when they leave, what they'll do is they will take hundreds, and I mean hundreds of small landmines, and they'll put them all around inside the village, in all the most insidious places, right in front of people's doorways, right inside bunkers where people have dug holes because there's airstrikes and mortars that go off. They'll put these landmines, hundreds of them, all around these villages, so that way they can't be used anymore. And of course, the villagers still come back, and then they go around with a knife and they're on their hands and knees going through the village, finding every single landmine that they can. And they'll pull up hundreds of them, but it's impossible to find all of them. And so inevitably, what happens all the time, we see this all the time, we'll get patients. They'll come in. It's a kid who stepped on a landmine, or it's a mom who stepped on a landmine, or whatever. Just somebody who stepped on a landmine in their own village, and it's devastating and it's horrible, but that's just the level of evil that I think people just don't understand. They don't understand that humans are capable of that and capable of doing that en masse. It's not just one psychopath, it's not just one psychopath serial killer who does stuff like that. It's entire groups of people. And the thing is, the people who do this, they are not psychopaths. They are not crazy people. They are normal human beings. And the reason they do evil things is because they believe evil ideologies. So I'm a firm believer that ideas have consequences. Ideas matter. Your religion, belief system, the ideas, the way in which you see the world, if you believe in evil ideology, you will do evil things. regardless of whether you're a psychopath or not. Get, you know, historically, obviously, the sort of the golden example is the is like the Nazis, right? But there's no way that the entire country of Germany that single one of psychopaths, right? Like, it's not possible. But you have this evil ideology that comes in there, and people are like, maybe Jews are a little rich, maybe, you know, this, that, the other thing, right? And yeah, maybe it is their fault. And so they start to accept these evil ideas, and that eventually, not right away, but eventually turns into dark, dark evil and concentration camps and things like that. But we still see that in the world today, just in different ways.
Why isn't that on the news?
Like what's going on in Burma?
Yeah.
So that's a great question. So a lot of the stuff actually kind of is on the news, but it's usually just written as articles on, you know, Reuters or Associated Press, or heck, even CNN, Fox News, they will cover some of these stories. The problem is when these stories are put out, they end up, they quickly get drowned out by the latest, whatever, celebrity gossip and political drama and whatever else is going on. So these stories are out there, which is the crazy thing. And people talking about these different conflict. So actually a project I'm working on during, so this year I'm at Harvard University, knocking out an MPA degree. And during this year, one of the projects I'm working on is I'm building something called the Overwatch. And basically what we do is we find all of these stories and we put them in a weekly email that'll come out, and it's for free. People can sign up at theoverwatch.co. We talk about all this stuff because we're just talking about Burma right now. We're not talking about the conflict in Ethiopia. We're not talking about what's going on down in Colombia. And there's so many different conflicts and things that are happening around the world that people just don't know about. Not because nobody's talking about it, but just because it's not mainstream news. And so what we do is we go find all that stuff. We put it in an email, and we also add some additional context because you're like, okay, what's going on in Burma? Okay, cool. I saw this headline about something happening in Burma, but like, who's the KNLA? Who's the SAC? What's the PDF? What is that? I don't know what that means, right? And so we add context into the email as well, so people can learn as they're seeing the news. There's a lot going on in the world for sure.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Most of the people who care enough, they really can't do anything. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. I mean, it's like people like want to talk about it, but for their physical abilities or to go over there and do, they just can't do that. I mean, the people are made differently. It's not that there's a lack of caring. It's just there's so much going on. Every country's in something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, so people do care. Like you said, to your point, like people absolutely do care. But like, what do you do? Right? How do you help? So, you know, for me, I found my frustration. I was like, I want to help, but I have the physical capability to go do that and the mental capacity to operate in those environments from my background as a SEAL. And so that's basically what my organization does, is like we hire ex-military guys to go into these places and provide the medical care and work in these environments. And so, for example, like if people wanted to support what it is that we do, what we say is, if you want to support us, why don't you just give like 50 cents a day or a dollar a day or something like that. So 99% of our income for our organization, we're a nonprofit organization, 99% of our income is just through donations from thousands of people every month who just give on average, I think it's like $20 or $22 a month, just on average. So it's sort of like a Netflix subscription. And so you are able to just donate a little bit and send people over there who are able to help. And I think that's probably one of the best things to do. So if you're able to, if you care about what's going on in these different conflicts, what I'd say is find multiple organizations that you like that are doing good work in these places. And, you know, why don't you give a little bit to Stronghold and then give a little bit to you know, another organization that's doing good work, other, you know, overseas in these different places. And that's a way to have a real impact, without having to go over and do it, and without having to take all the risk and such. And so that's sort of the model that we operate off of, is people can get involved in that. It's very difficult to actually go over there in person and operate in these environments, for sure.
Sure.
How long does your organization stay in each conflict zone?
Yeah, so right now we have a permanent presence in Burma. We've been there since 2018, basically, and we will have a permanent long-term presence in Burma, simply because it's such a difficult place to operate, and there's only a handful of organizations that can operate there properly. So we're there long-term. However, we do respond when there are active conflicts that pop off in different areas, and we'll stay for basically the first few months of these different conflicts. So for example, after October 7th, we went into Israel, into northern Israel, where no aid was going at the time. And we brought in a bunch of medical supplies, and, you know, tens of thousands of Israeli civilians had to leave their homes because Hezbollah was firing rockets from Lebanon into northern Israel. And so we went there, and we were doing medical training, bringing in a bunch of medical supplies. And we were there for the first few months, helping them get set up and deal with that crisis. And then, for example, during Russia's invasion of Ukraine, I was actually in Kyiv as the Russians were still advancing on Kyiv. Like, they were on the outskirts of the city, and we were in there preparing and helping the people get ready getting ready for the Russians to come down the road in a week or so, right? Luckily, the Russians turned back. We didn't have to deal with that, thank God. So we will go into places for a few months at a time. Also shorter trips into places in Africa, for example. We're doing a lot of work, or not a lot of work, but we're doing work with anti-poaching partners, because the people who are doing the poaching, they're the same ones that are trafficking drugs and weapons and humans. So it's all the same people involved in that. And so we go work with the anti-poaching park rangers, and we'll go into those places for a month or so, and really work with a ranger team, and go in the field with them, operate with them, and help them set up their medical evacuation capability, and help them sort of set up security in such a way, using what they already have to best protect the people who live in these national parks and such. So we've got a lot of little missions like that, but our main one right now is Burma. That's our permanent.
Are you getting a lot of our guys coming out of the teams going in your way?
I've had a few team guys come in and work as contractors in the short term. My full time staff right now, we don't have any former team guys, but we have guys come in all the time as contractors for short.
I figured, man, short deployment, especially with the younger guys now who aren't getting a lot of stuff. There's a lot going on, but they're not getting a lot of action. That's the crazy part about it.
Right. Right.
How about that? So that's
it's super frustrating. Yeah, the world's falling apart, and that was one of the reasons, again, why I got out. As I just saw that, I was like, I could see the writing on the wall. You know, the U.S. military is not going to send us into the middle of Africa to, you know, rescue a village or something. You know, this isn't the movie Tears of the Sun. They're not going to send us in there to do that. And I want to go in and help those people still.
Yeah,
and
so that's right.
Yeah, one of the obstacles that I have as well, even with recruiting for our organization, is there's no shortage of guys who want to come do stuff. The problem is that we got to have the guys with the right mindset, guys who are not thinking, I didn't get any action in the SEAL teams, so or whatever unit, and so now I'm going to go join Stronghold to try and get action. And it's like, no, that's not the mission set. The mission set is we are operating in those environments, you know, half of 1% of the time, you know. You know, there's combat or something involved, but we try to avoid it. We're there to serve these people. 99.9% of the job is logistics, it's medical care, it's training in medical care, it's just suffering in the jungle. Yes, you're armed, but you know, it's you're not there to get your rocks off. Yeah. You are there to serve these people.
If they did, if you do it right, here's the deal: is if you go out postured like you're looking for a fight, they'll run. But if you go out postured, mm-hmm. like you're going out to help somebody, like any kind of medical treatment or anything like that, they're the ones they go after. Mm-hmm. The helpless. They think you're helpless.
Yeah.
You don't think about it like that when you're in, man. It's like, hey, let's go get them. Like, well, they won't show up. But if you go out there to do something else other than fight, well, they will. They'll freaking show.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty insane. how yeah, medical workers and such will get targeted. And so because of that, we just basically, yeah, we keep our teams armed. Again, if the local authorities allow us to be, and yeah, we just try to serve the people as best we can. But yeah, it inevitably ends up with we're getting shot at just like the locals are getting mortared, just like they are. Yeah.
I noticed that my last trip to Iraq, I did a lot of med caps when we have some downtime, and that's usually when we'd get aggravated assault, right? It's kind of like stuff blowing up around you, pop shots and whatnot. But then,
oh wow, yeah, I can see that too. It's a soft target.
Yeah, soft target, people, man. We're overt.
Know exactly where it's going to be.
We're overt. It's daytime. We're out there. They know exactly what's going down, and especially who we show up with. You know, the kind of instruments are different.
So you're kind of like a more tactical Peace Corps.
Yeah, I guess you could put it that way. But yeah, I don't know how I would word it. We're kind of our own weird, hybrid thing. It's basically, I guess I would put it more, it's like, we're more like doctor borders, but we're armed.
Yeah.
And we actually don't have borders.
Oh.
So
I would say Inglorious Bastards.
Yeah.
Yes, like that, something like that. Yeah,
you're the Inglorious Bastards, huh? All right.
Yeah,
good for you, man.
Yeah, if only we were that cool. If only. Yeah,
that sounds cool. I mean, from what you're telling me, bro. I mean, good for you.
So, do you actually have doctors that go, or is it just people with medic training?
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
So it's primarily guys with medic training. We don't bring in, we do not bring in full-fledged doctors because the kind of stuff that we're dealing with, it's emergency, it's emergency-based stuff. So it's people stepping on landmines or getting shot and whatnot. And so we're stabilizing patients in very, very rough environments, extremely arduous environments, and then moving them to other clinics or other established places where there's other NGOs that are established and have medical care. So we're sort of the frontline guys. Our job is like, we're going to keep you alive long enough to get you to a real doctor. But our guys, we continue to put our guys through training as well. So they're continuing to, you know, maintain their skills, their medical skills and more advanced stuff. If we were to bring in a full fledged doctor on our missions where we're operating, it would be a waste doctor because he's not even going to have an operating room.
Yeah.
You know, he can go somewhere else where we'll bring the patients to you. You set up an OR. We'll find them. We'll bring them to you. Yeah. And there's no shortage of patients, unfortunately.
Better that way. Better
you
that way
more
with them
like
guys.
The 18 Delta guys. Yeah.
Who outfits your medical supplies?
We get all kinds of stuff from wherever we can find it. We typically try to source stuff. It's just cheaper and easier to find it. And we can still get decent quality stuff overseas. One of the problems we run into is like if we purchase a bunch of supplies, medical supplies in the U.S., it cost us a ton of money to fly with them overseas or ship them overseas. And then on top of that, if you go through customs with a backpack full of, or like a bag full of bandages or whatever else, or tourniquets, oftentimes if you have more than like a dozen or 20 of an item, oftentimes you go through customs, they'll pick up on that and then they'll charge you because they're importing items to sell in their country.
That's right.
And so we're like, no, that's not it. So we just try to source stuff overseas as close to the areas where we're working.
How about that for humans, possible. Man? Humans, we can wrangle ourselves into some stuff. I mean, we'll charge ourselves and we're doing it to ourselves.
Yeah.
It's the most amazing thing. But we do that for sure.
What's the city in Africa or area in Africa that's like, there's some big thing where they were kidnapping priests, Catholic priests. Did you see that?
That might be in the Sahel or in Nigeria, like northern Nigeria.
It's Nigeria.
Possibly.
Yeah. Where I think they kidnapped like 17 or something like that recently. It was a crazy deal. And then I never saw anything else. I saw a headline and then it just went away.
Exactly. So stuff like that happens all the time. A couple of missionaries were just killed in May down in Haiti during the gang violence down in Haiti. couple of American missionaries, and they just arrested a suspect who they believe was involved in the murder of these missionaries. So stuff like that happens all the time, and nobody hears about it. Like you said, it pops up for like 5 minutes on a news website, and then it just gets instantly, you know, buried underneath all the other celebrity gossip and such. And so again, that's why I started the Overwatch is specifically to highlight these stories, and people can just, it's a one-stop shop to find these stories. But yeah, there's lots of stuff in like sort of North Central Africa in an area called the Sahel, where the borders and everything are very porous. And there's these different Islamic groups. You got Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and these other just terrorist groups. They're some of them are kind of ISIS affiliated. But yeah, they'll run around and kidnap people for ransom. They'll kill people for, you know, that are different religion than them. So it's all just your standard terrorism, but just with an African twist, I guess, in Central Africa there. Yeah.
Crazy. Is your Overwatch actually up and running? Can people get on it now?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. People can go subscribe on the Overwatch, just the overwatch.co. And then right now we just have once a week, a quick summary, or basically a 5 or 10 minute summary of like everything that's going on in the world, all these different headlines. Comes out, and then later we'll expand it and do some more things with it. But people, it's up and running already. Yeah.
All right. Say that one again. How can people find you and follow you? And what do we need to do to?
The call to action.
Okay. Call. So if people want to support Stronghold, my nonprofit organization, they can go to strongholdrescue.org. And then if people are interested in learning more about just world events that are going on with some context in them, they can go to theoverwatch.co.
Are you writing a book about this?
So I actually, during my time in Iraq, I was in Iraq for about 90 days until I ended up getting shot by ISIS on a rescue mission. I did write a book about that, particularly those sort of 90 days that I was there in Iraq. That book's called City of Death, because at the time, Mosul was the deadliest urban combat that the world had seen since World War II. It's since been passed by Ukraine and other conflicts. But at the time, that's what it was called. So I wrote a book called City of Death. I co-authored it with Scott McEwen, who did American Sniper with Chris Kyle.
Yeah.
And that came out a few years ago. I'm keeping notes on all the different stuff that I'm doing now and working on it. In the future, I will almost certainly write about a lot of this stuff. But right now, it's still ongoing. We're still in active conflict zones, so I can't write about stuff because it's still ongoing and we're still going back to these places. But hopefully, in the next few years, quiet down in certain areas, and then we'll be able to talk more about that stuff without any security issues.
You got a YouTube channel? Like, I mean, with a GoPro on your chest where we can watch you when you're over there, because that's online now. It's like our version of Cops.
Yeah. Right. We actually just hired a guy to basically be our full-time in-house media, and we're going to be putting out more stuff, more high-quality footage and whatnot of what's going on. Again, even with like the chest footage and sort of GoPro footage, we got to be careful with that just because, again, it still is an ongoing conflict. So no, we don't have a YouTube channel up showing all that. But if people want to check out Rescue on Instagram, they can check that out, and we put up videos and clips of all these patients that we're treating. There's just like a never ending flow of people getting hit and wounded. So we're going to, you know, try to light more of that and continue to professionalize that and continue to storytell and let people know what's going on. Yeah, for sure.
That's awesome. Thank you for everything you do. God's
just work. Real fast though. Mr. Ballin was talking about you the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Did
you have him on the podcast?
No, not yet. I'm a big fan of his, and we have not met.
Yeah.
Y'all were in Buds together, right?
Yeah. We were in Buds together on SQT and the whole deal. Graduated,
oh, wow. Okay. So the whole thing.
Same class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm proud of him, man. I love his gig, man, what he's doing. I think it's great. And he was talking about you a little bit. And, bro, when the news came on and your freaking face was plastered all over, I remember when that happened. I was getting text messages. Yeah. I wasn't even in. And I was getting text messages about you. I have no idea who you were or anything like that. Like, hey, man, one of our guys is freaking. I was like, yeah. And then when we were watching that Mr. Ballin thing, he started talking about that too. And I was like, I remember that.
Yeah. So that was quite the strange, course of events, I'll just real quick recap that story, if that's all right.
Yeah.
For the audience. But basically, I went to Iraq, was working as a frontline medic, as I was talking about before. Well, one of the days we came across a massacre where ISIS had killed about 200 people and all their bodies were in the streets. We're talking women, kids, babies. There was one distinct family that I remember that'll never go away from my head. There was the father had clearly been holding the baby and had been shot in the back when ISIS had massacred all these people. And when the father was shot, he had fallen forward into the rubble and the baby's head had basically been cracked open and it obviously had died. And then the mother was also shot in the back right next to the baby, there. And so there's this killing field with hundreds of people, about 200 people. And there's piles of bodies where we see where people have been shot and then they climbed over the bodies of the dead and then they were shot on top of them. And then more people try to climb up on top of them. And so there's literally just piles of bodies. Well, in the piles of bodies, in one of the piles, there was a little girl who was hiding under her dead mother. And she was, she was not going to last much longer because of the heat out there in Mosul. And so we got up there, we saw the situation and we realized that the massacre was over at that point. And we got up there. And so we realized, all right, we have to do something to get this little girl. The problem was she's 150 to 100 yards away from ISIS. She's right there in front of ISIS headquarters. The only reason they haven't shot her is because she's basically hidden behind these bodies. And so we talked with the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army called the U.S. military. The U.S. military fired a smoke screen, airburst smoke screen for us. And then the Iraqi army drove a tank straight up to ISIS headquarters, an M1 Abrams, so it's an American-made tank. And we went in on foot behind them and got up there straight into right in ISIS territory, right like knocking on ISIS's front door. And ISIS, of course, immediately opened fire on us through the smoke screen. They're dropping mortars, pre-sighted mortars, getting behind us as we're advancing forward under fire. And machine guns are coming in from the front and from the sides, but they're kind of firing blindly. Anyway, we get the little girl, get back behind the tank. And as we're moving back to the tank is just backing up blindly. We can't communicate with it. And it's Iraqi soldiers, so we don't speak Arabic anyway. So could communicate with them, we can't say anything, or we can't understand them. Anyway, as we're moving back, I end up getting shot through the leg, through my right calf, as we're moving back, and I fall down behind the tank. The tank almost runs me over, but the guy would have run me, would have flattened me, if the guys on my team hadn't been yelling at me and smacking me, saying like, "Dude, get up!" And then I saw that the tank was going to run me over, so I stood up. Luckily, my leg held together, and we got back to almost to safety. And this is right where I'd seen that family that had been killed, and their bodies are right there. And they'd actually been killed about 6 or 7 feet, literally from the corner that they had to turn to get to safety. They were 2 or 3 seconds away from safety when they'd been killed. But anyway, I had to cross that open area to basically tell the Iraqi army to send an armored Humvee out to the team. So they didn't have to move across the open area because otherwise they would have all been killed. So I haul across the open area. ISIS immediately starts shooting at me. Bullets are, I don't know. They're really close. They're going right behind my back and in front of me. I get across the street and then I get them to send a Humvee. They send a Humvee to get the rest of the team and the little girl, and they bring them back to safety, and no one else was hurt that day. So when that happened, there were several war correspondents there who were filming different ISIS cities and were filming what was going on. The footage got released and, it was all over the news. It was all over everything. And, I was the point of the story. It was, our team and what we did, but, it was all over the place. So that's what, Marcus is referring to there.
Shit, bro. Everybody was talking about you being AWOL. Like, hey, man, he went AWOL. I mean, that's some of the stuff we heard. It's like, man, he just freaking had enough, got pissed, went over there and started whipping some ass. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
you're not team guys, are, man. If we don't know, we'll come up with something.
Yeah. I was hearing all kinds of crazy stuff. And I was like, no, I just wanted to go help. I thought I was going to be handing out water bottle. Ended up assaulting, ISIS headquarters in Mosul.
Good for you, man.
That's crazy.
Yeah, good for you. Wait, that's...
Yeah.
That's good shit, man. Good stuff. Thank you again for coming on and talking about that, man. I appreciate that. It's been...
Of course. Yeah, it's been awesome. Thank you guys so much for having me on. This has been super fun.
Next time you're in Texas, you'll have to come in person and we can have another sit down.
Where are you wanting to settle once you graduate?
We'll probably settle around the Milwaukee area for a few years and then kind of see what pops up from there. But yeah. Most likely Milwaukee. Where are you guys at? Where are you guys based out of?
Texas, outside of Houston.
Mm-hmm. Outside of Houston. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Yeah, I haven't been down there yet, but I'll have to.
Don't come in August.
Yeah, I'd love to.
It's too warm. It's too hot. I wouldn't want you here in August, man.
All right.
I don't want to invite anybody.
Sounds good. I might melt.
Yeah, yeah.
Although
you got to be born here for this.
We love Milwaukee.
Yeah, we'll come see you.
Yeah, we went.
Yeah, we'll
to,
come up there.
Yeah, come on up.
We had a Patriot tour in Milwaukee. I think in 2014 or 15.
Freaking love it.
We freaking loved that town. I had never been, never knew what to expect. It's beautiful there.
Went to a Green Bay game. I had a great time up there, man. It's just...
Oh, that's wonderful.
It's just way up there. I mean, y'all just got
yeah,
just
it is way
far,
up there.
Man.
It's way up there. But yeah, that's my old stomping grounds. That's home for
good.
Me.
Yeah. Good for you, man.
Well, thank you for coming on and sharing your story with us.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate it. This was super fun.
God bless you, man.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.